So last time I checked was at 9 p.m. and there were no questions on the Google Forms. But are there any questions? So if somebody has thought of something. All right, well, if you do have a question, please interrupt me. So before we start on representation theory, basic concepts of representation theory, let me just go back and mention something related to last lecture. There's a theorem, I think it's called Lagrange's theorem. And it says that for cyclic groups, so the order of some proper subgroup I think the word is divisor.
It isn't for cyclic.
It's not for cyclic?
It's for any finite group.
Any finite group. Okay, sorry. Yeah. All right. Thank you very much. For any. Okay.
I mean, it might be for infinite, but I don't know.
No, I think it's finite because infinite groups will have infinite order, right? So, yeah. Is a. I believe what you're saying, but I have to check because.
Yeah, sure.
As far as I can remember, I think it was. I read for cyclic, but it.
I'm pretty sure because I think we started we defined cosets. So
yeah.
You can just write the expansion in cosets for every subgroup.
Right.
For every group, but yeah.
Sure, yeah.
Check by all
means. Okay, I see. Yeah, I see your logic, yeah. Is a divisor of the order of the group. So if you have some subgroup H of subgroup G, then the number of elements of H will be some some positive integer times the order of the group that it's a subgroup of. So now the reason why I bring this up is that if the order of the group is prime, then we see that G cannot have a proper subgroup, and therefore G is simple. Okay? So if this is the case, then G is simple. The related notion of simplicity for Lie groups is slightly different, and we will touch upon that when we come to that. So today, I wanted to go over the basics of representation theory, and at the end of the class, kind of tell you a qualitative story, which many of you may know, about how the Lie algebra, how a Lie algebra arises from Lie groups. So, it involves subconcepts of differential geometry and stuff like that. So, I won't have time to introduce all those concepts. But, I can sketch the outline. But it won't be very rigorous, but I'll give you a reference where you can read about it in painful and gory details. Okay? But before, a much more practical stuff. So basic definitions of representation theory. So in physics, we are not so much interested in groups as abstract entities, but as how they act on physical systems. And so we are interested in mainly, you know, we are interested mainly in representations of groups in terms of linear operators. So these linear operators can be, for example, say differential operators or, as often is the case, matrices. And they act on some finite dimensional, in the case of matrices, or infinite dimensional vector space, in the case of differential operators. So what is the definition of a representation? So the representation, and I will use rep for short, of a group G is a map, say D, of the elements of G onto a set of linear operators such that the group properties are reflected in the linear operator. So for example, the identity element maps into the identity operator is the identity operator, you know, acting on the, you know, vector space. The group multiplication is respected by the natural composition or multiplication in the linear operator space. So you know, group multiplication is respected. So if, you know, A, B, and C are three elements of the group such that AB is equals to C, it should be that D times A, D of the map of these elements, also like this. There's a caveat here. So in quantum mechanics, there can actually be a phase here. And that's because in quantum mechanics, states are defined up to a phase factor. So in quantum mechanics, a phase is possible. And such representation are known as projective representations. And I'm not going to say much more about that. If you want to know more about these subtleties, I think Weinberg has some in volume 1 of QFT, Quantum theory, Quantum Theory of Fields, I think it's called. That has more. All right, let's do some examples, right? Oh my God. So it's kind of a matrix representation of C4. So we looked at C4 last time. And this was alpha, alpha squared, alpha cubed. This was the identity. Now, I don't recommend you do it right now, because matrix, sometimes, you know, doing matrices by hand is takes time. But let me just tell you, and you can verify later, that these matrices give you a representation of C4. Okay, don't worry, I'm not going to write two more matrices. So this lecture would be a little bit less interacting from the interactive than the last one. But you know, I'll try to find some problems along the way that we can all engage in collectively. So another example, so this is a representation of C4. And this is a matrix representation. So another representation, say the example number two, this is example number one, is of C4 is this representation, where all the elements are mapped to the number one. So this is an example of what is known as a trivial representation. And just because something is trivial doesn't mean it's not interesting. And we'll see that in quantum field theory, the scalar field would be a trivial representation, in some sense, of the Lorentz group, although an infinite dimensional. From a certain point of view, it is trivial. But you know, because it's a quantum field, so it has infinite number of degrees of freedom. Anyway, a scalar is usually a trivial representation of some group in question. All right. So an important question, an important concept is the idea of a faithful representation. So if a representation D of some group G is such that every element in G is mapped to a distinct element D of G, then we say that D is a a faithful representation. Otherwise, the representation is unfaithful. So if you actually calculate these matrices, you'll see that they're all different matrices. And therefore, that's a faithful representation, and that's an unfaithful representation. So these are simple ideas, but important. So let's do another example of C4. So it should be more obvious. Okay, before I do that, let's just introduce another concept. Equivalent representations. So two representations, say D and D prime, are said to be equivalent if, so there exists an operator S, and it could be a matrix or something, even a differential operator, such that these two representations are connected by a similarity transformation for all elements in G. If that's the case, then these two things are called equivalent. So let's do an example. So it's easier to verify, in fact, you can just see it directly, that this representation of C4 is a faithful representation. Right? It's kind of should be obvious. All I've done is that I've inserted some complex numbers, which if you raise them to the power 4, it gives you 1, right? And now you can verify that that representation and this representation are indeed equivalent, because you can find a matrix S such that these two things are related. And I leave that as an exercise for you to verify. The S is given by, obviously it's something I cooked up. So this is, shows that the two things are equivalent representations. As you know, in the world of matrices, two matrices are said to be equivalent if they're morally the same thing. If they're, you know, all the important properties of matrices are unchanged under this transformation, right? Okay, any questions? Now this representation shows us that it's actually, there are two representations here, right? So there's the number one, this phase, minus one, and this phase. They themselves form a representation of C4. And these guys, one, 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 they form the trivial representation of C4, right? So this gives us, brings us to the concept of a very important concept, an irreducible representation it's hard to emphasize how important this concept is. So a representation D is set to be reducible if it has an invariant subspace. What do we mean by that? What we mean is that if the action of DG for all G is on a subspace of the full space that these guys act on, remains in the subspace. Okay. So let me make it even clearer. So if, in other words, say P is some projection operator onto some subspace, say, on V, the vector space that this acts on, then if this is true, so this is going to act, this is going to be acting on some vector space on the right, and P is on is some subspace of the vector space. If this is true for all G, then we say that D of G, that D is a reducible representation. I think this is such an important concept that I want to go even deeper, give you even a more explicit formulation of this. Yes?
Is P, could P anything?
No, P is, has to be a projection operator.
Yes.
Yeah, so it has to have the usual properties of projection operator, that P square equal to P, so that it has to satisfy that. But so, yeah.
To find out if D is reducible, we just need to find one P that's
right. Yeah. Yeah. And you're not guaranteed that the projection that you can actually create that it's going to give you something that's actually that's not a trivial representation. So if you choose your P to say project down to a very small portion of your vector space, then you'll find that you're projecting D to some the trivial representation. Okay? So I'm going to tell you how I understand this. So in practical terms, like when I say practical terms, I mean my practical terms. So this means that there exists some S such that the similarity transformation on the matrix, on the representation matrix breaks it up into block diagonal pieces for all G, so where these D of G's are, they form representations. They form reps of G. Okay, yeah?
Right, so just to go back to Fati's question there, to be reducible,
yeah,
it's not just that there has to be one invariant subspace, but that it can be decomposed,
yeah, it can,
entirely invariant. It could be that there is one invariant subspace, but the rest.
Oh, right, the others don't form a, like you can actually project down to, a subspace, and the complement of the vector space don't have to form a representation.
I think this is reducible, so there has to be one invariant subspace, but there's another term, I don't know the term in English, when you break it down into completely.
Decomposable?
Yeah, decomposable.
Yeah, I think that's, yeah.
So this block diagonal thing.
I think that's a decomposable. Yes, that's decomposable. Yeah.
So yeah. Are we requiring that the subspace in question is an orthogonal complement to the rest of the space?
So I mean, I see that this definition doesn't require that. Whereas, when I write like this, it just seems that that does require it. So there seems to be a tension between this definition and it's this particular. So I think it is a related idea, but this is what you're calling a fully decomposable.
D1 to whatever are all irreducible, right? So.
Right, exactly. So this is a stronger version of that. So in practical terms, I've always kind of, in physics, I've rarely seen, I'm not saying it doesn't happen, it just, I haven't seen it in my experience. So it's a very subjective statement. So, but I just wanted to kind of give a more visualizable, version of this idea, because sometimes writing in terms of abstract operators, this is a very interesting, maybe I'll come back to some of this in the next lecture with an example or something, okay? So there's also an idea which is called the fully reducible, and I find this a bit confusing. So if D of G can be brought to the form where D of G consists of block diagonal matrices, for all G, but they don't actually form, these blocks themselves don't form a faithful representation. So this actually is in the literature, this is called fully reducible. And there are examples of C4 where, you know, you can actually, and you know, I'll give you the example. I can actually think, I don't have a tip with me. Where you can actually write your, you can actually diagonalize your matrices, but you know, they are not, the blocks themselves do not form a representation.
The blocks have to, but they don't have to be proper. Just by like.
That's what I mean. Yeah, that's what I mean. They don't have to be faithful representation. That's what I said.
They have to be a representation.
Yeah, there. I mean, there can always be some trivial representation, but they can. Sorry, you had a question?
Yeah, I think my question was just as an easy example, just an identity matrix.
I mean, that's.
Irreducible?
You know.
Well, you can't just take one matrix, but.
Right. I mean.
All of the matrices that represent the.
So let me, like. I have an example for C4, which is of this form. I'll give it to you tomorrow. And but so okay, let me just like write this out clearly. So the, if D of G can be brought to the this form, you know, where you know, the AIs are not necessarily. Faithful representations of G, then we say that G is fully I kind of don't find this concept very useful. I've never, but I think it's good to go there because they're kind of related, and you know, you will come across it in the literature and so that you're aware of it. Yes.
Does it have to be the same transformation matrix for all G?
I think yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
In that case, how is this different to what we have on the left? I might be missing something obvious, but
right. I mean, I think.
I think the one on the right has to be, so they have to be irreducible, and we didn't say that they have to be for the ones on the left.
Yeah, that's.
And also the fully reducible one, if we define
so
it as they're
irreducible.
If we define it as not necessarily faithful, and A1 to AN are irreducible, then it's basically the same thing that we said was decomposable. So just we call it differently. Because I thought you said originally that it's not that they aren't faithful, but here you say that they're not necessarily. So we don't know. That is the same definition as for the decomposable.
Oh, right, right. So if I, okay, yeah.
The fully reducible implies decomposable, which is this one here.
Right. So this is more decomposable? Yeah. Okay. What I guess I was implicitly thinking about is I was thinking of these guys as being faithful representations. If I relax that condition, then there is really no difference between these two things. Okay? Yeah?
So one more time, on the left, the D1, to be decomposable, the sub-representations have to be faithful, and on the right, to be fully reducible, the AIs don't have to be faithful.
So I have to check that you know, the technical, what you know, what you're saying, decomposable, I've actually never, you know, come across that term before. So the way I was defining this is that these guys have to be faithful. If they're not faithful, then these two things become identical, okay? So let me come back, you know, there's probably a matter of nomenclature here as well.
Okay.
So.
So the little D's don't have to be irreducible?
Yes, I was thinking of these. Sorry, can you repeat your question again?
Like the D1, D2, don't they have to, like when you decompose?
No, they're irreducible, but whether they're faithful or not, that is the question.
Okay, but yet they are in fact.
Yeah, they're irreducible. Because if they were not, you could actually incorporate that fact into the S matrix that you found and actually have them break down into smaller pieces, yes?
I might be wrong here, and I'm kind of fishing from the depths of my memory here, but
right.
I think that the distinction between two names here comes into play when the space is infinite dimensional.
Okay.
So that every unitary representation of a finite group is necessarily fully decomposable.
Okay.
I don't know. I'm not positive this is true, but I think I remember it from somewhere.
Okay. Every unitary.
Every reducible representation is fully decomposable for.
Yeah.
So for finite groups, it's definitely true. For infinite groups, if it's a compact group or something, I think.
Yeah. Some restrictions apply, but if it's reducible at all, then it's fully decomposable and reducible.
Okay.
So,
I
think the idea of using matrices in the first place to describe this visually might be impairing our.
Right, I see. Okay, okay. Well.
The distinction between.
All right. So, yeah, I'll look into this, and you guys can also look into that, and we can have another discussion tomorrow. But thank you very much. Yeah. Okay, so let's move on to the next topic. And in the next 5 minutes or so, let me sketch. Why groups are so important in quantum mechanics and. Some of you may have seen this, but. The result that I'm going to present right now is so ingrained into the structure of quantum mechanics that we don't even think about it anymore. It's really, it's also taught in a way that one almost thinks that it might be one of the axioms of quantum mechanics, but it's actually not true. So group theory, groups and quantum mechanics. Okay, so symmetries play a fundamental role in quantum mechanics, and that's due to a theorem by Wigner from 1931, and the statement is something. I'm going to give you a light version of it. So the group of symmetries of a quantum system. Is represented by linear unitary or antilinear and anti-unitary. Operators acting on the Hilbert space of the theory. So the standard reference these days for this seems to be Weinberg, Volume 1, Quantum Theory of Fields. This should be here. So let me give an outline of a proof. goes something like this. So suppose you have a state psi 1 and psi 2, which are in your Hilbert space of the system. So some you make some transformation, a symmetry transformation, so of the system under symmetry transformation. Say psi 1 goes to some other state, which is some operator times psi 1. Right. Now, because it's a symmetry transformation, and you know the dynamics of the theory is invariant under this transformation, the probabilities should be invariant. So and Weinberg proves this using observers. I kind of don't like that because some of the internal symmetry groups don't really have to do with different observers.
I would just say that unitary operators preserve the scalar product, so we know that it's going to be conserved.
Yeah, exactly. That's very big way. Yeah, that's like it's so trivial. It appears that you know we don't actually think about these things, right? So the solution of this condition is that U is unitary, which means that but there's another solution where it says U is anti-unitary. And if you assume that U is linear, then the second condition also leads that U has to be antilinear. In case you don't know what antilinearity is, so antilinearity means that U acting on, say, let's do an example. It turns out that many quantum field theories that we see in nature are time invariant, or many quantum systems are time invariant. In fact, under the microscope, the Schrodinger equation is kind of a complex heat equation. But the fact that this is complex is very, very important because the heat equation, as you know, it is a dispersive equation. There's like a direction of time built into it, right? We don't see kind of, we always see some, you know, distribution of stuff kind of, you know, spreading. We don't see them kind of coming together. Whereas under the microscope, the dynamics of quantum particles seem time reversible. So the fact that the Schrodinger equation is actually complex is an extremely important feature of quantum mechanics. So if time reversal is a symmetry of some system, that means that it should commute with the Hamiltonian. So the time evolution of some state is given by a time evolution operator, right? So now if I apply the T operator, the time reversal operator on this thing, I should get this. But on the right-hand side, we get T I've inserted the identity here. Now, if you apply two time reversals, you should get the identity. So that means that T inverse is just T. Right. However, from this, you know, from the time evolution of the state, we know that we can actually evolve states backward in time. That thing should be given by plus IH of t. And this I can write as T E minus I H T T psi of 0.
How did you go from that?
I'm using the fact that the argument of the time dependence of the state is, you know, the sign is switched. So if I put 0, you know, I should get 0, right? Right.
Wait, sorry, could you just explain that again? How did you get the very last thing on the right
there? I used this, the fact that when I set t equals to 0 here. The small t, the argument. So, and also, like, okay, I can write this as. So this thing acting on this gives me psi of 0. And I'm using the fact that t inverse is t to write this as.
Okay.
All right, so what we get here is that this thing should be equal to this. Other words, this should be equal to but that should also be then equal to this. So this implies that t e to the power minus I h of t, this thing, is plus iht. Now the t in the exponential is just a parameter. It's a real number. The operator should not act on it. So it should not, you know. So if this is true, then, and t is a unitary or a linear operator, then this cannot be true, because then T will, you know, this thing will commute with the Hamiltonian, and therefore this will commute with this factor, you know, and T squared is 1, and this gives us a contradiction. This gives us, this is, we are saved from a contradiction if T, say acting on something, say T times I is minus I of T. In other words, if T is an antilinear operator, okay? If T is an antilinear operator, then this equation makes sense. And so we see that, so this is a very heuristic, you know, like hand-waving argument, but we see essentially that the time reversal operator actually is implemented as a as an antilinear operator. Yes?
You you know, expand the exponential out to first order, apply it at t equals 0, and see the relationship there that way.
Right. So you mean
you would see that it's a contradiction if you expand it. Yeah. But
yeah.
You don't have to, because when you expand, I mean, you know the t and h commute, so you know that when you expand it, you can just like already reverse the like
the
e to the minus iht t times t.
Yeah, I was just saying, like, if you expand it, you can see the relationships easier.
So, yeah, you're saying e to the power. Yeah, you're right. So this, that's what you mean, right? Is, and therefore, yeah, this kind of shows that it's, yeah. Okay, good. So let's take a short break, and let's meet back here in 5 minutes, okay?
Inverse is the same.
So suppose it's are already supposed to be on. Explain again why t minus 1 is bound to be t, like what are the assumptions you're making?
Sorry?
Could you please explain again why t minus 1 is bound to be t, like what are the assumptions you're making?
It's a ray, right? So you can have a phase. But I'm assuming for the moment that we can have a theory where we can choose that phase to be one.
If you were to choose the phase as minus one, then you would have T linear, right?
Yeah, but I think that's going to give you lots of trouble elsewhere. First of all, that won't be a unitary operator then. So before we move on to the waffle that I wrote last night about group Lie algebra and Lie groups, there's one last thing I want to touch upon. I'll give another example of how group theory manifests, how groups manifest themselves in quantum mechanics. So these are, you've come across these kind of examples in your undergraduate quantum mechanics. I'm just slightly formalizing them. So it's like Molière when he said that he didn't realize that he was speaking prose all his life. So degeneracy and quantum mechanics and group theory groups. So suppose G is some group of symmetries of some quantum system. I like the word quantal, which actually is the adjective for quantum, but very few people seem to use it. So this means that So if D is the representation, it seems that then it means that the commutator of H with D vanishes. Now let psi be an eigenstate of the Hamiltonian. And now let the subspace of the Hilbert space, you know, spanned by applying all the D's on these eigenstate. So for spanned by be, say, given by some set of linearly independent, some linearly independent set. So let me explain what I mean here. So this is a linearly independent set. So what I mean is that take this state psi, apply all the DGs on it, then you get, but you know, you get some set, right?
I mean, that set is spanned by
these. Yeah, exactly. And that set is spanned by these linearly independent sets. So that space has some dimension n, right? Now, since DG commutes with H, all of these have eigenvalues, energy eigenvalue E. Now this, let's examine what D looks like acting on this subspace. So D of G, say acting on psi of I is going to be, let's do a decomposition of identity here. Now, when I'm doing this decomposition identity, it's really only enough for me to decompose in this subspace. Why?
Because it's invariant.
And so for example, if in the sum, because you know, in quantum mechanics, we usually, you know, sum, you know, when we do the decomposition, we are doing the decomposition of the whole Hilbert space, right? But why can't we just get away by doing
the other projections are gonna be zero.
Right. Mm-hmm. Okay, so good. So then we see that this is going to give us psi of j and these n by n matrices acting on psi of j. And this is going to be an n by n irreducible representation of g. So we know this from quantum mechanics. The matrices acting on a spin state of angular momentum j are 2j plus 1 times 2j plus 1 dimensional. Times, yeah, right? So that's an example of this. All right, so let's move on to Lie groups and Lie algebras. this is really where the real core starts. Right. So Lie groups and was were introduced by Sophus Lie in the 19th century, and he was trying to understand the geometry of this solution space of differential equations. So here we move from discrete groups to continuous groups. So we are going to be dealing with continuous groups. What are continuous groups? These are groups which are parametrized, where elements are parametrized by set of continuous parameters, real parameters, most. No, doesn't have to be parameters. In fact, I think in supergroups, the parameters can even be Grassmannian. Example, we already saw U1, which consists of these guys, where theta goes from 2 pi to 0. So we can identify the parameter space of U1 with the circle. So we can write that this is, the U1 is actually some kind of is a circle. Because of the continuous nature of the parameters, it's natural to think of Lie groups as manifolds. You guys know what a manifold is? So I don't. I only know what it locally looks like, and I know that globally.
That's the definition.
Yeah,
local,
yeah, but, yeah, exactly. That's the physicist's definition, okay? So when I went to Cambridge to do part three, my first class was this amazing lectures by on general relativity by John Stewart. And he was just talking about manifolds all the time, and I freaked out. So I started going to pure math courses. And so in the end, you know, I kind of fell into this trap of infinite regression until one day, you know, the penny dropped and said, ah, I only have to know the fact that a manifold is something that locally looks like a flat, you know, Euclidean space. It's an Rn. So I try to read the appendix by in Wall's book. But I think there are some nice examples of spaces which are not Hausdorff. Anyway, so let's, what is the definition of a Lie group? Okay, so a Lie group G is a group which is also a manifold. So I'm not going to belabor some of the things that you already know. So it is, for example, equipped with a multiplication which is a map from G times G to G, and there exists which has the usual properties of groups, with the usual properties, with the usual properties. So the set includes a identity element and for each element there is a unique inverse. Now, it'll turn out that which one is identified as the identity element will depend on how we parameterize the group. So right. Okay, we are in the last stretch, so actually, no, I'm still going to use the blackboard. There's a fourth fixed blackboard in the back. Okay. So suppose that the group elements are parameterized by the set phi, which phi is phi 1 dot dot phi n, then we write that a generic element is like this, and the identity is then when we set all these phis to zero. That's how the identity element is defined. So let me make some remarks. The number of elements in the group is infinite because the number of points on a manifold is infinite. So that's not the order of the group is no longer a useful concept. But the number of independent parameters that you need is known as the dimension of the group. This dimension may or may not be infinite. For this course, in most of PSI, it'll be finite. However, one way of looking at gauge groups of gauge theory is that they're actually infinite dimensional groups. Because you have a group at every point in space-time, and therefore you actually have an infinite dimensional group. In the study of gauge theory in Yang-Mills theory, that kind of it's kind of usually glossed over, that fact. However, this fact becomes very important in string theory, where there's a notion of affine Lie algebra or Kacemudi algebra and Virasoro algebra. Those are infinite dimensional algebras, okay? So they are essentially gauge groups, and they will be infinite dimensional. Okay, so although Lie groups can be thought of as abstract entities, in this course we prefer to think of them as matrices. In fact, most of the important groups that we'll discuss will be defined in terms of matrices. Okay, so we concentrate on what are known as matrix groups. So they are groups defined by some matrix equation. And we'll get to some examples of that in the next lecture. You already saw SO2. Okay, so let's just start. I won't be able to finish it today, but let's start on the relationship between the Lie group and Lie algebra. And rather than having this discussion all abstract, I'm going to use a particular example as a crutch. I will use as little of that example as possible, but I find that sometimes when somebody's describing some notion, abstract notion, it's good to have an example in mind. That's how I think, but. And then you can generalize to more abstract thing later, but. Okay, so the one line wisdom is that Lie algebras encode the structure of the Lie group around the identity. So it's a local description. However, there's a lot there to unpack. So let's consider a spin half particle. So its wave function is given by some vector, like a two-dimensional column vector, right? So and now let's consider rotations. So rotation by theta around some direction, which is given by some unit vector n. Then the rotation is implemented, as you know from quantum mechanics, by this matrix. Okay? Where this is the set of the three Pauli matrices. which I'm assuming you're all familiar with. This factor half is extremely important. Otherwise, we would not get Fermi statistics. So when we have bound state of, when we have two identical particles, it helps, you know, we actually get an antisymmetric wave function. And now, let me introduce some geometric concepts. And one of them is a tangent vector. So what I'm going to say from now on is going to be a little bit heuristic, and I apologize for that. If you want more rigorous stuff, I gave you the reference of an online book that I wrote with a friend of mine long ago. It has details, like in pain, it's described in painful detail. Like, you'll be sorry that you read it. But any books on, you know, a good book on Lie group will have nice discussions on the geometry of the Lie manifold and their relationship to Lie algebra. Okay, so what's a tangent vector? So suppose we have a curve on our manifold. So it's a set of three numbers, but they depend on some parameter t. So this is our manifold, M, and this is some curve. And the coordinates on these curves are given by theta, because it's a three-dimensional manifold. There are three coordinates. So the tangent vector to this curve at the point which is parameterized by, say, t, so t is some real number, is given by So this is what we mean by a tangent vector. So we can think of v as a local vector pointing in that direction.
Sorry, this is a vector when you put an arrow down.
Yeah, sorry, yeah. Everybody puts it upstairs. I know I put it downstairs.
Yeah.
The person, the first lecture I ever had as an undergraduate in physics, he used this underbar, and I have not been able to break that habit. Although I realize it's a minority habit. You know him, Harun al-Rashid. All right. So this is a coordinate representation. So this is a coordinate representation of the tangent vector. Now I'm going to use the tangent vectors that we will work with are kind of similar. All right, so let's play a little bit with these matrices. Because I don't know how much most of you are probably familiar with these matrices, but some of you might not be. So, and if you're doing quantum information, or mostly quantum information, these are matrices which crop up quite often. So for example, let's finish the class by doing a little exercise. Okay? So sigma 3 is this thing. And you know that sigma 3 squares to the identity matrix, right? In fact, all the Paulis square to the identity matrix. So if you haven't done this before, can you spend the next few minutes to show that this is equal to cosine of sigma 3 by 2 How many of you have seen this before? Pretty much almost everyone. So those of you who haven't, I leave this as an exercise. It's not very involved. You just have to expand this exponential on the left as a power series and use the fact that the sigma 3 squares to the identity. And then you will see that all the terms reorganize in cosine and sine. So it's kind of the analog of Euler formula, but for Pauli matrices. Okay, so because most of you have seen this, I'm not going to pour over this. So this holds for all the Pauli matrices. Now, the Pauli matrices don't commute, right? So Paulis don't commute. Like this could be, okay. So that means that the group that is formed by those matrices, so the group formed by these things is a non-abelian group. So you can take, for example, I theta 3 by 2 sigma 3 and try to work out I theta 2 sigma 2. And you'll see this is not zero. And you know, this formula should help you do that. You can also use the properties of the Pauli matrices. So I'm not going to call this a Lie algebra yet, because for me, it's just a property that the Pauli matrices have. Okay. Okay. So let's just, let's just do one more thing and then we can stop. So let us define the exponential map. So given a Pauli matrix times I times half, the exponential map maps it to the exponential of this thing up to some parameter by some parameter. These factors for the range of values of theta, and I think in this case, they actually form. So I think theta here is, hang on, do I want to say that? Because the thetas don't always have to be form a circle, right? So I was tempted to say that they form an abelian subgroup because, as you can see, that if I take exponential of I say sigma, let's just say sigma 1 theta, and multiplied by e to the power sigma 1 theta 2, theta 1 and theta 2, then we get e to the power I sigma theta 1, theta 2, right? And we see that, you know, it doesn't matter whether it's in what order it is. It gives me this thing. And then I can say that the inverse of this guy is just given by this. And the identity matrix is the, yeah, I think it does form an abelian sub.
So you're saying it's abelian if it just fixes one sigma?
Yeah. So I was worrying about the global topology of the parameter, but I don't think I have to worry about that.
Just whether it's a real line or a circle.
Sorry?
So the reason it doesn't matter is because whether it's a circle or just like a
line, it doesn't matter, right? Yeah. I was worried. You see, I just thought that maybe that could be an issue, but turns out it doesn't. So this is an abelian subgroup. And anyway, we shall carry on tomorrow. And tomorrow we'll actually see some matrix groups, okay? Thank you.